Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, Netflix released its latest tranche of viewer data a few weeks back, and folks have been kind of sifting through it, looking at, you know, what the numbers are telling us, dissecting the entrails of the you know, crow or whatever. I don't know what you take entrails of. The first thing that jumps out is that the most watched stuff is stuff we would never talk about on this show, mostly. For instance, the most watched movie of the first half of 2024 is Millie Bobby Brown's Damsel, a movie that is real and exists. It accumulated more than a quarter billion hours of viewer time, which translates to nearly 144 million views. For the ease of discussion, I'm just going to use the views metric, which is the total runtime divided by, or the total number of hours watched divided by the runtime. So just FYI. The Kevin Hart movie Lift, another movie we would probably never discuss unless we were really hard up for a topic, was second with 129 million views. Kids' movies heavily represented in the top 20 with relatively recent titles like Super Mario Bros. And Despicable Me 3 sitting alongside older fare like Boss Baby, Minions, and Shrek. Shrek. Huge on Netflix, Shrek.
Boss Baby.
Boss Baby. What we got to remember here is that Netflix is basically a stand-in surrogate parent for most parents. You know, it's the babysitter that we all hire when we don't have the wherewithal to actually contact a teenager. We just put them in front of the Netflix machine, let them go. All right, but again, it's, you know, that's like another big area of viewing. It's something we don't really cover too much here. One we did cover in one of our bonus episodes, Zack Snyder got the 14th and 15th spot on the list for his Rebel Moon movies. You put them together, and they added up to the third most hours viewed of any film. So that's a big win for Zack Snyder and Netflix. This is it's a project that paid off. Good for them. They should keep giving him nine figures to keep making movies. The only movie that even remotely qualified as a prestige-style picture that was near the top of the charts was Society of the Snow. It's kind of a retelling of the story of Alive. It's by a director we like. I forget his name.
Jay Bayona.
Yeah, thank you. He's a good director. It's a popular, prestige-y type movie. 104 million views. Good for it. Got a couple Oscar nominations. That means it did very well for Netflix. But as Matthew Bellany noted at Puck, most of the prestige stuff from Netflix really has trouble finding an audience. Like, here are some of the numbers from the end of 2023 to the beginning of 2024. I'm going to give you title, release date, and number of views here, just FYI, these are the things you're getting. Nimona, June 30th, one nomination, 42.4 million views. Naiad, November 3rd, two nominations, 27.5 million views. Maestro, December 20th, seven noms, 12.5 million views. May, December, one nom, 9.8 million views. Though to be fair, Netflix only has the US and Canadian rights to that one. El Conde, September 15th, one nomination, 4.9 million views. Rustin, November 17th, one nomination, 4.7 million views. American Symphony, November 29th, one nomination, 2.4 million views. To Kill a Tiger, March 10th, one nomination, 1.8 million views. Now, these numbers are across two reports because it's the end of 2023 and the beginning of 2024. Though, again, some of these it didn't really make a big difference because they're being released in, you know, November, December, whatever. The point here is pretty straightforward. For all the focus on award season, prestige-style pictures on this podcast and other podcasts and amongst reviewers, for all the talk about, you know, the what we consider to be the buzzy titles that Netflix is putting out, the simple fact of the matter is nobody actually watches them. They don't capture the eyeballs. Now, there are two distinct points to make here, both of them amounting to who cares? The first is that the prestige pictures have always done worse than the blockbusters, theatrically, wherever, at least in recent decades, right? Who cares if nobody is watching them? And the second is that it's still good that Netflix is making or funding or buying these pictures because no one else really seems to be doing it. If Netflix execs want to blow a bunch of money on movies no one watches so they can be feted during award season, well, who cares? It's their money. It's their, they can do what they want. Alyssa, should we really care that no one watches Netflix's prestige stuff? Which leads me to my very important follow-up question. Should we pivot to being a Millie Bobby Brown podcast? Should this be a podcast that focuses on nothing but the hottest hits on Netflix, the real slop out there?
I mean, we should care because if nobody watches this stuff at some point, Netflix and other stream outlets might stop making these kinds of movies. And that would be unfortunate because some of them are good. Not all of them are good. I did not like Maestro. I think that viewership probably is more viewers than that movie deserved because I'm a crank. But broadly, yeah, if streamers stop their investment in a kind of, you know, broadly well-made, handsomely directed, well-acted movie for grown-ups, we'll have fewer of those movies and we'll be bummed out. And that's too bad. I think it's nice that Netflix wants to produce these kinds of movies. So, you know, like Ted Sarandos can have something to say, like, as a fig leaf beyond sort of destroying the entire entertainment ecosystem. I think it's nice that Apple wants to spend some of its just giant pile of cash on these kinds of movies. But yeah, if nobody watches them, there may come a day when they don't get made at all, and that would be a bummer. I would like to live in a media ecosystem that could support more of these kinds of movies. I also wonder if some of these types of movies, like, if you sell 12 million tickets to something, that definitely translates to some more money than maybe, you know, the pennies that they generated for Netflix. But I don't know.
12 million tickets is a lot. I mean, that's
it's a lot of money.
Is there any way for that to be less than $120 million in total box office revenue? I don't think so.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, and then you have to split it with the theaters and everything.
Sure, but we talk about total revenue, not theatrical splits, right? Like, yep, any movie that sells 12 million tickets is like
doing well.
That's a bunch of, well, not necessarily doing well. There's a bunch of movies that have made $120 million recently that have definitely not done well because they cost $400 million with marketing to make. But that's a lot of money at the box office. Like, that's going to put you on the charts for any given year. But none of these, the other point to make here is Maestro is not selling 12 million tickets at the box office in any world, in any, you know, version of a 2020s type year.
Absolutely.
Maybe if you go back to 1984, but like,
it's
not in our adult lifetimes.
Can I say, as to the second question of whether we should become a Millie Bobby Brown podcast? No, but we should absolutely become a Bridgerton podcast. We should, like, Netflix should make more Bridgerton, and we should become a Bridgerton podcast, and we would make a lot of money.
I would feel uncomfortable taking part in the Bridgerton ecosystem after the scam Bridgerton event. Did you guys see this story?
How is that the fault of Our Lady of the Bodice Ripper, Shonda Rhimes, right?
I'm sorry. That's obviously their fault for creating this illicit demand for a middle-aged lady sex show. We got to put a stop to that. We got to put our feet down on that. I don't want to support that.
To all of our listeners, that when somebody advertises an across the movie aisle dress-up ball, we have nothing to do with that. Or I don't know, maybe Alyssa does, but the rest of us have nothing to do with that.
I will personally guarantee you. That we will only do one Bridgerton fake ball sometime next year. We'll see.
I think you all should email in and insist that we have an Across the Movie Aisle Bridgerton fake ball just so we can force Peter and Sonny to wear waistcoats and cravats.
Yeah. Well, luckily, just as in Megalopolis, we are not a democracy. All right. We'll get to that in a minute. Peter, I mean, here is the thing. So you make the very good point. I think that 12 million tickets are not being sold for any of these. And like, outside of the heyday of Miramax, where they were, you know, doing the occasional Shakespeare in Love or something like that, it has not really ever been the case that at least not since the 60s or 70s, you know, when there was a confluence of prestige and blockbuster appeal, when something like The Godfather could be the highest grossing movie of all time and one of the greatest movies of all time. You know, like, we have moved away from that universe into one in which 12 million, if 12 million people watch Maestro on Netflix, that's about 11.5 million more than ever would have watched it if it had not been on Netflix.
Yeah, so I think this just points to the problem that has been increasingly apparent for about 20 years with prestige Hollywood, which is that prestige Hollywood has increasingly divorced itself from the interests of more ordinary, of mass moviegoers, of people who, of the sort of large lump of people who aren't hardcore movie fans who see at least 10 and maybe 50 movies a year. And that is one of the reasons why we saw, for example, the Oscars expand their Best Picture category to as many as 10 nominees from 5, because there was a sense that that the prestige part of the industry had become too separated from the interests of the masses. And that's something that we still see with Netflix and with the data there. It is also just true that in our lifetimes, really, the last 40 years or so, we're all around that age, since 1980-ish, since you know, the sort of blockbuster era started, they're just, those types of films have often, not always, but often struggled, even in the heyday of Miramax, even, you know, in the, we're going to mint zillion-dollar hits out of Sundance and elevate and find Steven Soderbergh and the next set of Steven Soderberghs. A lot of those movies that were supposed to go big just kind of didn't. They got bought for big numbers out of the festival circuit, and then they didn't make their money back. And so I don't see this as wildly different from what the situation was 10 or even 20 years ago. And the thing is that people who are in the movie business always want to do two things. They want to make great movies and they want to make a lot of money. And ideally, you do those at the same time. But that's really, really hard to do. It's been really, really hard, maybe not forever, but certainly for basically all of my lifetime, for the era that I am familiar with. And I don't think that that has changed. I think, frankly, it's harder than ever. And the thing that we all have to, you know, sort of contend with, that Netflix has to contend with, that we talk about sometimes on this show, but it's just that there are so many other choices. And part of what has happened is that the kind of the competition for entertainment time, and in particular for screen-based entertainment time, has just heated up so much. And that's a lot more movies being made, but it's also video games. It's also YouTube. It's also TikTok. It's also whatever else people are doing on their phones that I can't even come up with because I'm a middle-aged guy and I don't know what people are doing on their phones. And that is going to mean that these products, these sort of prestige products that are aimed at somewhat more sophisticated audiences or that don't have a kind of natural giant market for them, that are niche products to some degree or another, that they are going to face an even more difficult fight for people's time and attention and dollars. And you see that on Netflix. And the fact that Netflix is still involved in funding these things, and it's not clear that they really need to, is mostly a good thing, because Netflix is helping to keep this stuff alive in a way that I'm not sure that studios could if Netflix didn't exist. And yes, if you want to make the argument, the most cynical interpretation here is that the Netflix execs, Ted Sarandos, they don't really care themselves about this. Oh, they like the prestige, it's fine. But they do care about keeping Netflix in the good graces of real artists who care a lot about making great movies. That's important to them. And so that secondary tranche of like, we do want to make sure that great filmmakers come here and work with us, that makes a big, that's a big deal. And the fact that there are still those filmmakers out there who are, even if they're not making great art, even if you hate Maestro, they're trying, right? They're taking bigger swings than you might see with, I don't know, Damsel, whatever the hell that is, the Millie Bobby Brown movie. Right, they're trying to do something that's original and interesting and, you know, sort of artistically substantive and rich. And Netflix is willing to pony up for that
to keep those people happy and to make sure that Netflix doesn't become disfavored amongst real artists, because they know that even, like I said, even if Ted Sarandos himself doesn't care, even if it's totally cynical, there's somebody out there who is there are filmmakers out there who do care and who are being brought in and then given the opportunity to do interesting work because of this. I saw just today Guillermo del Toro's Frankenstein just finished shooting, and that's a Netflix product. I didn't even know that was being made, and I'm like, where does that get made for whatever Netflix is spending on it with Jacob Elordi, if not Netflix? These movies, Netflix is making things happen that I don't think in many cases would happen without their sort of absurd, their ability to spend on stuff that doesn't necessarily make direct financial sense.
Yeah, Alyssa, Peter said an interesting thing, and I want to drill down on this for a second, because I think it does matter. He said Hollywood has kind of divorced itself from what audiences are interested in the prestige realm. And I really feel like it's kind of the opposite, that audiences have kind of divorced themselves of the sort of movie that becomes both a prestige title and a blockbuster, right? I mean, I do think that there has been such a audience migration to the world of the comic book movie, etc., that the causation here is a little bit backwards, right? Or am I wrong? Is that not right?
I feel like that's a question with a multidimensional answer, right? I mean, and it's interesting to think about what the answer is if you're talking about television versus if you're talking about movies, right? Because, you know, something like House of the Dragon is still pulling like a pretty big viewership from HBO, I think. I would have to check those numbers. But, you know, House of the Dragon has a lot of the sort of trappings of what came to be understood as prestige TV, even though it's very different from something like The Sopranos or even Breaking Bad, which is, you know, one of the more sort of action oriented of those sort of golden age of television shows. And, you know, I think it's been a long time since, you know, sort of Oscar style adult movies were pulling kind of mondo audiences. I mean, something like Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is both, you know, a product of a sort of small personal artistic vision that, you know, pulled in a pretty good audience at the box office. I'm flailing around here in part because I think the question of sort of what even constitutes prestige in both TV and movies is kind of a fluid category right now. And, you know, what audiences show up for seems very sort of variable and inconsistent. You know, I would have to go back and just sort of dig into the box office data a lot more to produce a sort of consistent timeline for, you know, what audiences really showed up for relative to what won awards. I mean, I think our sense is that something has gotten broken in the ecosystem, but I feel like it's hard for me to make a more historical argument.
Yeah. No, I understand what you're saying. I mean, it's right before we started, we were talking about La La Land and Midnight, yeah. or Moonlight. And that Oscar race. And it's interesting because La La Land was actually a fairly big hit as far as like Best Picture nominees, musicals, whatever goes. Like that movie did pretty well. And Moonlight is maybe the lowest grossing Best Picture winner of all time in a non-COVID year.
Yeah, I mean, La La Land made $447 million worldwide. That's
yeah, and but Moonlight won, and the question I guess is Moonlight winning a, and we don't have to answer this question here, it's just something to think about, but was Moonlight winning a function of Hollywood rewarding different things, or was Moonlight winning and not getting box office bump really a function of audiences not showing up to the old things that Hollywood made? And I think that's a, I don't know, I think that's a, it's an interesting and harder question to answer. But we're running long here, so let's move on. All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that no one watches Netflix's prestige stuff? Alyssa?
It's a controversy. People should watch good stuff, and good stuff should be able to find an audience somewhere, and the people who own it should, you know, maybe work harder to have some of that stuff in theaters and, I don't know, create a feedback loop that works.
Yeah. Peter?
I think it's a non-controversy, actually. This is repeating the... this is just a new form of, in some ways, the old, well, not maybe not the old, but what has long been the way of things with prestige pictures, which is a lot of money goes into funding these things, even if they individual films are not necessarily all that expensive themselves, Megalopolis obviously aside, and only a few of them ever managed to break out.
I'd say it's a controversy that people aren't watching them, but it is a mild controversy that Netflix can't, that Netflix hasn't really been able to really capture that audience. But again, maybe it's just not there. Maybe the audience has just moved away to TV shows entirely where the numbers are better for the more prestigious stuff. I don't know. Interesting to think about. All right, make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday when we're going to be discussing one of our favorite marketing gimmicks of the last few years, at least one of my favorite marketing gimmicks of the last few years, the mobile Criterion Closet, aka the windowless movie van. It's just a van that drives around with free movies on the scrawled onto the side of it, scratched into it like into the paint. So I'm excited to talk about the free movie van. All right, now on to the main event. Megalopolis, the decades in gestation project from Francis Ford Coppola, hit theaters this week after a tumultuous production period that began sometime after he finished Apocalypse Now. Nearly began filming in the 1980s and then got kind of spiked. Wound up being funded by the sale of Francis Ford Coppola's Coppola. I keep pronouncing Coppola wrong. It's Coppola. His Coppola winery and the use of his own $120 million to finance the picture. While shooting, there was drama. There was drama in the form of unhappy crew members on the set leaking damaging stories to the press, including potentially libelous stories about the abuse of female extras, and a rancorous debut at Cannes that included both a lengthy standing ovation on the one hand and disastrous reviews from critics who were nonplussed by the weird motion picture they were subjected to on the other hand. When discussing Megalopolis, I think it's important to set some expectations. If you go in expecting something like The Godfather or The Conversation or even Apocalypse Now, which is kind of weird, but weird within normal parameters, you're going to be disappointed. You're going to be disappointed. That's not the sort of movie you're getting here. You have to understand this movie. You have to think of this movie as a nine-figure version of the movies he's been making for the last 20 years or so. Pictures like Twixt and Tetro and Youth Without Youth, all of which are deeply personal ruminations on life and death and the legacy and what we're doing and the meaning of it all. Sentence case there, right? The meaning of it all. Twixt and Tetro in particular are suffused with elements of Coppola's own personal life, including the drowning of a child, the burden of family geniuses who don't think much of your work, etc., etc. While some of these, like Twixt, are a bit more experimental than others, they all play with ideas and structure and linear storytelling and aren't terribly concerned with appealing to mass audiences. It's funny, I rewatched Tetro last week, and it's a pretty straightforward film. It's not terribly convoluted or anything, but it's also black and white, starring Vincent Gallo and Alden Ehrenreich before he was Han Solo. I mean, it's very much a movie that is not designed to appeal to huge audiences.
So, I mean, that's going to sell at least 12 million tickets, right?
It may have sold 12 tickets.
12
tickets, Megalopolis. Yeah. Megalopolis is much closer to Twixt than The Godfather, is what I'm saying. All right. Adam Driver stars as Caesar Catalina, an architect and head of a bureaucracy in New Rome known as the Design Authority. He has the power to stop time, which is kind of cool, but unclear in its usefulness. He has developed a magical material called Megalon, which he can use to shape into whatever he pleases. And what pleases him is the sort of utopian vision that you see on like the wall of Epcot Center in 1980. It's like all gleaming curves with like all caps. Futura font, the future, and moving walkways, taking people about, and the such. I mean, it's really like somebody in 1980 was like, what will things look like in 2030 or 2040? And they decided to keep that vision. Standing in his way is Mayor Franklin Cicero, played by Giancarlo Esposito, who believes that the people do not need dreams. They don't need dreams. They need apartment complexes made of concrete and steel, and they they need casinos, both to provide employment and entertainment and build a tax base for the city. New Rome is, of course,
also, how are you going to watch sports without a casino?
Exactly. New Rome is a stand-in for New York City, specifically, and kind of America more generally. It is decadent and stagnant. The elites are partying in vulgar excess while the poor stare on from the sidelines, sadly looking at them with their big eyes and their dirty clothes. The whole thing, this whole movie is brought to life. All the you know, fantastic imagery and all that. Is brought to life by the volume, right, which is the massive LED screen, room screen things pioneered by the folks who made The Mandalorian, other TV shows. Some movies have used it as well. I mentioned this in my review, but the movie that Megalopolis calls to mind for me is Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch, right? At least insofar as it's narratively messy, it's very personal, and it's an almost experimental effort to bring a wholly unique vision of the world to life. Whether or not that world works, whether or not the blue screens and the volume make it work, whether or not you like the look of that thing, the whole kind of Attack of the Clones aesthetic of it, is a secondary question. But at least I understand and appreciate what he was going for. I'm fascinated. I want to talk to you guys a bit about this in a minute, but I'm fascinated by the politics of this movie, which, like, are first off completely incoherent, just completely incoherent. But that puts him very much in the world of the median voter, who has a completely incoherent set of views on everything. But it's also like kind of, I use this term advisedly. I know it's kind of loaded. It's fairly straightforwardly fascist, maybe kind of accidentally fascist. But what I mean is there's like this subplot about a populist rabble rouser who's played by Shia LaBeouf, who's clearly designed after Donald Trump, right? He's talking about, you know, we gotta make New Rome great again or whatever. And he says something in that vein. And he's the villain of the picture insofar as that it has one. And he, you know, again, he tries to use the rabble to kind of seize power and take it away from the real people who care about the city. But the real lesson of the film is that we need a brilliant leader above it all to guide the dull masses and the corrupt elite out of the muck in which they wallow, so we can all experience a brighter future. You know, democracy be damned. The people don't know what they need or really even what they want. It's not Randian. I've seen this movie described as Randian, as in Ayn Rand, but it's definitely not that. Objectivism is its own weird thing. But it's like a sort of soft Randianism, right? This idea that brilliance needs to be allowed to shine unabated and uncovered, and doing so will illuminate everyone's lives. The impoverished masses here don't really have wants or desires of their own, or at least we don't know what they are. Their existence in the film is almost entirely aesthetic.
They want not to have their apartment blocks, demolished. That's the one need, that's the one sort of wish that they articulate.
Yeah, well, I guess, but we never actually hear that from them, really. There's one shot of a crowd going like, don't demolish our apartments to build new apartments. We don't want that.
Two shots, but yes, I would agree that it's not clearly established what it is they want.
Their whole purpose in this film, again, it's like entirely aesthetic. They are to exist on the outskirts, kind of looking in on the rich elites partying and as a way of kind of shaming them. Anyway, ultimately, Megalopolis is a plea from a filmmaker who has watched his industry and his country kind of collapse in on itself in the face of the pursuit of extravagant wealth. He wants us all to take a step backwards and let artists inspire everyone to something greater. It's almost, the movie is almost syrupy in its earnestness, right? The darn thing closes with a pledge of allegiance to humanity. This is what I mean when I say it's not really Randian. Like, the Ayn Rand would have vomited at that sort of thing. But it is... You know, it says we need to do everything for all the people, as long as the people allow us to be guided by our artistic betters, unfettered from things like the profit motive. I don't know. Peter, you were not particularly enamored of Megalopolis. Am I right in saying that?
That's accurate. Look, I really wanted to like this movie. I think Francis Ford Coppola has a legitimate claim on being the director with the single best decade and the best four movie run in Hollywood history. I think he has made great films, movies that I have watched over and over again that I think are just unassailable masterpieces. And this movie, sadly, is not one. And what the problem with this movie is that
I admire it so much. And I really wanted this to work because he is reaching for greatness and he is asking people, he is demanding greatness from art and from society, from culture, maybe kind of from government. We can get into the politics a little bit more later. But this movie is a demand for greatness. And that's something that I respond to and that I think we need more of in this world. It's a demand for ambition. And you see the ambition in this film, but the ambition that he displays is so clumsy. It's so obvious. And the other problem with it, and the big problem with that ambition, is if you want to demand greatness in art and in society and in culture, and you say that we need to dream of a better world, then you need to show me that greatness yourself in the thing you are making. And there is no greatness here. There are interesting and outlandish and sort of non-commercial bits that I found kind of fascinating. But there is no actual greatness on screen. And so the only way this movie works is if you can connect it back to Francis Ford Coppola's earlier great works, because like I said, he has created great works. And so there is a way in which this movie, kind of cashes the checks, in some cases, in some ways, sort of literally, because he sold his winery that he built with his earnings from, you know, his previous movies, right? But like, there is a way in which this movie kind of cashes in on the greatness that Coppola has established throughout his career. But it doesn't show us greatness itself. It doesn't deliver on the promise of let's reimagine cinema. Let's reimagine society. Let's build a better world. It's, you know, and it some ways responds to that by saying, well, what's important is to ask the questions. Okay, that's a good start. But if you don't, those questions don't lead you anywhere. They don't give you actual greatness, something that inspires you on the screen in the moment. If you don't prove yourself capable of it, then what you have is this movie, which kind of looks like it was shot on an iPhone 4, is mostly incoherent from a narrative perspective. And to the extent that it has a politics at all, is kind of weird. Like, I mean, there's a sort of there's an interesting anti-populism that, yes, I think draws from Randianism, but is definitely could not be described as a kind of a straightforward objectivist Randian vision or anything like that. But there's just not enough there that coheres and connects. I thought the first act of this movie was quite promising, but even though it, like, from the very beginning, it is kind of incoherent. But the first act is like, wow, this is really reaching for something incredibly ambitious. It's trying to go big and go far. And the middle portion of this movie is what? Like, it doesn't deliver on it. Forget delivering on greatness. The middle hour of this movie doesn't deliver on the essential promise that the first act makes, which is a conflict of visions between two ways of thinking about what the world should be. Either forget the sort of prosaic basic needs of the now and build something beautiful and wonderful against all odds that is excellent, that you can all see is simply has made the world a better place and is going to live on for posterity, and that future generations will look back and think that was great. Or you can build something that's sort of like, well, you know, the people need housing and gambling and entertainment right now, and this is a cheap and straightforward way to do it with concrete. And like, that's an interesting conflict. It's not really developed at all throughout the middle 75 minutes of this movie, because this movie doesn't know how to deliver on its own vision. And if it had delivered even partially on its own incredibly grand, incredibly sweeping, ambitious vision, I think I would have given it more of a pass. But you have to, if you are going to demand greatness, you have to deliver at least some of it. And the only way that Coppola can say I delivered greatness is, well, look at that 4-movie run from the 1970s. Truly great. And guy gets a ton of credit and a ton of slack, leeway from me for having done that. I will just accept, like, dude, you get to make whatever movies. And like, I am in some ways going to applaud him and say, I'm glad you're making stuff. But I don't think this movie works on its own terms. And I don't think it delivers on what it demands from the world.
I think you're wrong here. I think it does actually deliver on the conflict between the utilitarian now and the grandiose future by introducing a deus ex machina where the city just gets wiped out. The middle of the city just gets blown up by a USSR satellite that falls from the sky that we've seen a couple times in the movie and then just shows up and does the thing we need to have it do.
You're just happy that this movie like implicitly makes the commies the bad guys.
Well, but it's funny. I mentioned Sucker Punch, but you know, the other movie this calls to mind is Watchmen, where it's just like New York gets destroyed in the middle and, you know, everybody comes together.
At the end. And the way that New York is destroyed in the movie version of Watchmen is so terrible.
No, it's actually better. It's much better. But the
controversy, my dude, we're stopping 10 minutes on this right now.
No, it makes way more sense than some dumb space squid. But this neither here nor there. The real issue here is that we haven't discussed the acting.
Extra-dimensional art project
space
squid.
We haven't discussed the acting at all, which is the real reason to see this movie. Yes. Alyssa, I want to get your take on this because I do think that like trying to discuss this on a narrative or plotting or even ideological or political level makes less sense than just like sitting back and letting the performances wash over you, letting Aubrey Plaza as Wow Platinum and Adam Driver as Caesar Catalina. I mean, just everybody in this, Natalie Emanuel as Shia LaBeouf chewing the scenery, John Voight shows up and like every scene is delivered from him at 130 miles per hour. Like it's an amazing, there's so much energy on the screen. That I feel like Baz Luhrmann was sitting there watching it being like, wow, this guy knows what he's doing. This guy knows what's up. Alyssa, what was your favorite performance in pick one? And it has to be Aubrey Plaza.
So Aubrey Plaza's performance in this movie cracked me up because she's essentially doing a riff on a role play that her character on Parks and Recreation slips into from time to time. So there's a whole riff in Parks and Rec where her character, April, dresses up as this character named Janet Snakehole and walks around and says things like, I'm Janet Snakehole, I'm a very wealthy woman with a terrible secret. Or like, my sister didn't, I didn't burn down the mill and my sister didn't either. And like, Wow Platinum is just like a riff on Janet Snakehole
Jim Cramer, by way of like CNBC's Jim Cramer.
Well, specifically Maria Bartiromo, right? Who is like the money honey, like reported from the floor of the
Is that where she got her star? I had no idea.
Shtick was like she reported from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. She was known as like the money honey. And I mean, she did like sort of genuinely groundbreaking financial journalism in that position. But also was like known for being, you know, a hot woman on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And like the money bunny thing is just a direct Maria Bartiromo riff. So I actually did not think Plaza was that great in this, in part because she's so clearly channeling that character. I mean, I loved Adam Driver in this. I'm a huge sucker for Adam Driver. I think like, I mean, come on, he shows up and just like, his character delivers the soliloquy from Hamlet, and it's an incredible performance of that soliloquy that he's delivering in character and does so in a way that tells you an enormous amount about his character, much more so than any of the sort of exposition about how he has a Nobel Prize does. Like,
it's by far the best scene in the movie. I agree.
It's fantastic, right? It's just, it's a beautiful performance of the soliloquy as the soliloquy, but also the fact that his character is giving this virtuosic performance just to mess with his political rival and to sort of make a parallel point about sort of the value and danger of dreams. It's just, it's amazing, right? And it's done like a sort of model unveiling for this area that's being redeveloped. And Driver is ridiculous. We're blessed to have him. It's a real bummer that he is not in, like, that he's not getting to do, that he's not, that he, that Francis Ford Coppola has not provided him with the sort of roles that he provided Al Pacino and Robert De Niro in the Godfather movies, because just, like, getting to see Adam Driver directed by Francis Ford Coppola at his peak would be just an all-time cinematic experience, and I'm deeply, deeply bummed about it. I think, you know, Sonny, to a certain extent, you're right about just sort of letting the performances wash over you. I mean, there are individual scenes in this movie that are very funny, right? I mean, Shia LaBeouf, like, throwing his hat on the floor and ordering his henchmen to pick it up, and then, like, every successive sort of henchman down the hierarchy doing the same thing is very amusing. You know, Voight is often quite funny in this and is sort of playing age in a way that I think involves a surprising lack of vanity and that I really appreciate. But I actually think this movie's problem is that it is not quite weird enough to be transfixing. It's weird enough to get you to look at it and be like, that's weird. And I think in part that's because the sort of the metaphor of America, the second Rome, is incredibly belabored. And I can say how belabored it is in part because when I was an intern at The Atlantic, I ended up working for Cullen Murphy, who was writing a book that turned into Are We Rome? This was almost 20 years ago at this point, where I literally went through my job as his research assistant was to like go through Nexus and find every reference to America as, you know, sort of a parallel to Rome. And the stack of printouts for it ended up being like several feet high. So this is an incredibly belabored metaphor. It is not sort of a transfixing one at this point. And, you know, this is Megalopolis, a fable, but it is not sort of constructed as a fable in a way that would genuinely be weird and surprising, right? Like, we know that Caesar and, you know, later Julia, like, have the ability to stop time, but that's not made use of at any point in the plot. And, you know, I think the actual better parallel for this movie is not Sucker Punch, but as I texted you guys after seeing the movie Southland Tales, which is, you know, sort of a movie that's also kind of famously a disaster, like basically blew up Richard Kelly's career, but is a much more successful movie at creating a sense of strangeness that, you know, it's sort of set slightly in the future. You know, it's a world very much affected by America's incursions in Iraq and Afghanistan. There is the presence of a similarly sort of megalomaniac project, the introduction of this energy source known as fluid karma that turns out to like tear the time-space continuum apart. But that movie was incredibly successful at conjuring a mood, at, you know, sort of precisely tweaking every element of the American experience by like 15 or 20 degrees in a way that produced a world that was recognizable, but sort of nausea-inducing to inhabit. And it is so much more effective as sort of a dark fairy tale and as a fable than this is at any point, right? I mean, just doing the like, okay, Americans have their bread and circuses. We have professional wrestling. Like, I mean, this is sort of a silly thing to harp on, but the fact that like the worst kind of, you know, sort of decadence and moral ruin, you know, that Coppola can dream up for this is like girls kiss each other at nightclubs and like a guy cross dresses, right? I mean, there's just like, there's sort of a lack of imagination, even about sort of like decadence and corruption and downfall in a way that makes this movie feel very, just very half-hearted as a fable, along with everything else.
The place where you see this movie's gestation period is in the script, which clearly has like held over elements over the last 40 years. Like, it's clear he's just been rewriting and like layering stuff on top. And as a result, certain plot threads are kind of vestigial. Like, for instance, Dustin Hoffman, who we haven't discussed at all. Dustin Hoffman is in this movie and gets murdered like 80 minutes in for some reason.
A little more than that, I think, but yeah.
Was kind of unclear to me why, but he like disappears for a long time and then he shows up in a flashback and he's murdered. But it's clear like that was a whole subplot somewhere that got like written down. But the difference, I mean, the big difference between Southland Tales and this is that, again, this is a movie that has been in the works for so long, you can feel layers of sediment almost on top of each other. Whereas Southland Tales was written in the midst of the Bush years. This was like, it came out, what, 2006? It was like, this was 2005, 2006.
Four or five, but
comes out in the midst of the war on terror and the reaction to 9/11 and the Bush years and like, and how, and it as a result, it does capture something else that's, you know, it's very of the moment, almost too of the moment. If you go back and watch it, I mean, it is dated in a very real way that places it in a time, but also, you know, places it in a time, and
that can be good movies from that era. I mean, Lions for Lambs, even V for Vendetta. There's a bunch of stuff that came out around that time. It's just like, wow, this just feels like you somehow or another whipped up a movie out of by reading the A1 on the post in the Times for a week.
And this is why I think Megalopolis is at least has the potential to be more interesting in the longer term, because there is a timelessness to it. It is of such an extended period of an American, of American decadence. People have been saying America has been decadent for 60 years now, 70 years now. And this movie encapsulates a large amount of that, which is interesting.
I don't know. I mean, I'm just not sure that it ends up sort of drawing parallels between those sedimentary layers enough to make it interesting. Like, you know, Southland Tales is like that movie's a disaster, but it's one that I kind of love. The story that totally. When my husband and I were not yet dating, I once forced him to watch Southland Tales starting at midnight on a weeknight, and he married me anyway, which says something about both his quality as a human being and my obsession with that movie. But I don't know that there's enough that feels memorable about Megalopolis that I can really see it lasting, right? Like, other than Driver doing Shakespeare, I don't know. I am not sure that there's going to be anything that is sort of as indelibly weird about this movie as there was about Southland Tales. I don't know. I could be wrong.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Megalopolis? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
Wish I could give this a thumbs up, but I can't. Thumbs down.
I'm going to give this a thumbs up on general principle. The principle being good for it existing. That's how I kind of look at this movie. I'm glad it exists. And I'm glad Coppola made it, and I hope folks check it out. But I think it is an incredible mess throughout. So, you know, it's a mixed thumbs up for sure from me. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If no girl will die. If you did not love this episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.